From the headquarters of the American Radio Relay League in Newington, Connecticut, this is ARRL, The Doctor Is In, a bi-weekly podcast addressing common and some not-so-common technical issues in amateur radio. This podcast is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. And now, here's your host, QST Editor-in-Chief Steve Ford, WB8IMY, and the Doctor himself, QST Contributing Editor Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Welcome to The Doctor Is In. I'm Steve Ford, WB8IMY.
And I'm Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
It's time to go postal, Joel.
Oh, my God.
Now, this is our July 5th mailbag.
All right.
It's during the Independence Day break that some people get.
Oh, yeah.
Some people get. So it seems like an appropriate time to dip into the slush pile and see what we can come up with. But no, we have a number of good questions here. So are you prepared, Joel?
I am prepared.
You are braced and ready. Okay. This is Dwayne, K6PLS, and he's asking, what is SDR? And what is needed to use it? That's simple, Joel.
Yeah.
You probably have very little to say about that.
I can talk for a long time about almost anything. And some people question whether I know what I'm talking about or not. But SDR is short for software-defined radio. And it's in its simplest terms, a software-defined radio is just a radio whose operational characteristics can be changed just by changing the software, rather than by getting out the soldering iron and wire cutters. And it was originally defined or set up by the Federal Communications Commission, thinking in terms of commercial radio equipment. And their idea was that if they had a radio whose characteristics could be changed by software, and they evaluated it to make sure it met all performance requirements for one service, and it could be changed by software, chances are they could recertify it for a second service without having to go through the whole testing rigmarole again. Whether they were successful or not, I don't know. But that's what the idea was, so that you could have one radio that could serve in a number of different roles, which is very handy. Now, in the amateur environment, what we're talking about is a radio that at some point in the processing of signals translates a analog signal, such as we receive off the air, into a digital signal through an analog to digital converter. And at that point, from that point on, the processing of the signal from the radio, and this also goes the other way for transmitting as well, is all done digitally and can be done on a computer. So you can do different sorts of demodulation, you can do different kinds of selectivity with digital signal processing, all kinds of things you can do once you've made the conversion from the analog mode to the digital mode. And some people have different ideas about what exactly makes a software-defined radio, because nowadays almost all modern transceivers do some parts of what they're processing digitally, and often they have the capability to be upgraded after the fact with some kind of firmware change, either by downloading something from the internet or from a CD-ROM disk or a SD card or whatever. So most radios have some aspects of this. And I guess the purest of software-defined radios is something we're just really starting to see showing up in the market over the last year or so, and that is one that makes the conversion right at almost at the antenna.
Yeah, almost right at the antenna, yes.
At RF signal frequencies. I mean, when they started this, the digital to analog converters could work mainly in the audio range, and many of them used computer sound cards for the process. So you had a bunch of analog processing first that did the conversion from radio frequency down to a lower frequency, and then down to something in the either audio range or just above hearing audio range in the tens or hundreds of kilohertz, and then processed, changed to digital and processed that. So you had kind of a hybrid between analog and digital. Well, there are some radios that have come out recently, and I'm tempted to mention some names and numbers, but I think I won't because I'm sure to leave somebody out, and that wouldn't be fair. So, but there are a number of them. You check the QST product reviews for them. I just reviewed another one that I just brought back today, in fact. So watch for the details in the product reviews about what the architecture is. If the sampling and conversion to digital is taking place at the antenna frequency, so you have perhaps an amplifier, but nothing else in front of the
maybe
converter.
Some filtering or
some
something.
Filtering,
yeah.
Yes. Filtering is very common because you don't want to overload the analog to digital converter or you get all kinds of problems. But by doing it that way, just about everything that happens in the radio is happening digitally, and sometimes the filters can be digitally controlled and so forth as well. Sometimes they can track the tuning as you go to make the narrowest possible filter. In so doing, all aspects of the processing are done digitally and able to be modified or upgraded by different software. As software improves and so forth, the features can be expanded. The same circuitry can be used for all kinds of different modes of operation. And it just, it makes for a very smoothly operating system. Now, there are a couple of flavors of this. Some of them look like a box, like a computer, and have no knobs or displays. And everything shows up on the computer screen itself. That was fairly popular. But now, many of the radios that are coming out that are of that form include all the processing within the radio itself and actually have displays and controls. So you look at the front of the radio, and it looks like a traditional radio with a display and a tuning knob and other knobs and buttons and so forth. It's a little hard to tell just from walking up to one what it is, but that's why you have to look at the description of the architecture. But that's what a software-defined radio is. And your question was, what's needed to use it? Well, you need to have a radio that's a software-defined radio.
You don't necessarily need a computer.
That's true.
You really don't. Not anymore.
That's true, yes. The newer ones have computation built in to the radio itself, which is sort of the opposite of the way they started. And they started with mostly an analog radio with a computer sound card connected to it that did the analog-digital conversion, and then the processing occurred at kind of audio rate sort of things, which could sort of limit what it could do because it only had its computer hooks onto the last stages of the reception and the first stages of the generation of signals. But now it's gotten quite different. It can be very effective. A lot of the problems associated with traditional receivers, such as various kinds of intermodulation distortion and other kinds of things that happen in nonlinear stages, happen in conversion stages. And if you eliminate the conversion stages, some of those issues disappear. So it makes it a lot more straightforward. And some people have noticed that such radios sound much clearer. They have less distortion, less artifacts, and so forth. And that can be a real plus. Of course, the downside is you do have to worry about the dynamic range of the analog to digital converter, because if you hit it with too hard a signal, all of a sudden it goes into overload and it causes all a digital version of all those problems, essentially, which is trading one problem for another. But there are a lot of things that radios do that can avoid that. The one I was looking at had a indicator that indicated it was overloading, and so you have to reduce the gain or change the filtering or something to get rid of the extraneous signals, and then it worked fine. So it's a very popular technique now, and I think you'll see more and more radios that are designed that way.
Okay, let's take a break for DX Engineering, and we will come back with yet more questions.
Ever talk to a salesperson who didn't know the difference between a rotator and a rotary phone, or a Yagi and a yo-yo, or a Balin and a ballerina? You'll never have that problem with DX Engineering. When you call us, you'll talk directly with knowledgeable amateur radio experts, people who speak your language. When you contact DX Engineering, you're dealing with operators who are as passionate about the hobby as you are. This means better service, expert technical advice, and a commitment to your complete satisfaction, even long after your purchase has been made. Whether you're newly licensed or a longtime operator, you'll always find a friendly ham who understands exactly what you need on the other end of the line. Plus, you'll find a huge selection of amateur radio equipment, get the fastest shipping in the ham universe, and shipping is free on most orders over $99. Let's talk about your station. Visit us at dxengineering.com. That's dxengineering.com.
And we're back with yet more questions.
Maybe I'll have some answers here.
Going deep, deep in the mailbag, we have Russ, KD0QH, and he's asking, in your discussion of RFI getting into computers during your January 4th podcast, you mentioned using ferrite toroids on interconnecting Ethernet cables to reduce picked up signals. I have had success with switching over to shielded cables. How do they compare? The ones that I like have a translucent jacket so I can examine the overall shield. Well, I know there are shielded Ethernet cables, or CAT cables as some people call them. How do they compare?
Well, I think they both are trying to do the same thing, which is keep signals from getting into the equipment on the ends of the cable. The shielded Ethernet cables try to do that by avoiding the cables picking things up, while the ferrite toroids try to avoid the problem by not allowing currents that are picked up to flow from the cable into the equipment. So they're two slightly different approaches to the same problem, and they're independent, and therefore they can be combined, which sometimes, in my case, has been successful. Well, first, a little bit of background. You have to remember that when Ethernet started back in the, when was it, 70s maybe?
I think so.
Yeah, I was working on it back then actually at one point. But the basic technology was switching at 10 megabits per second. And the original Ethernet cables, well, of course, originally it was actually on coax, but that quickly gave way to twisted pairs, I think mainly because that was kind of what telephone company folks were used to for transmission. They like twisted pairs, and twisted pairs have been good for many years at audio frequencies and seem to work also at 10 megabits per second to avoid crosstalk between multiple twisted pairs in the same cable. So if you notice that, your Ethernet cables have multiple twisted pairs, one for each direction. Sometimes there are more than just two. There's often four pairs in a cable. And the twisting tends to eliminate the coupling between the pairs. And the phone company got very good at that for audio frequency work. And you rarely hear a neighbor on the phone if you're using proper cables. Mm-hmm. And I've experienced buying cheaper cables at a local electronic retailer to extend a telephone line and found, oops, now with the two lines in our house, they no longer can be used separately. There's always a little bit of common communication going on. So they got good at that. But what happened was Ethernet then expanded from 10 megabits to 100 megabits to a gigabit. And I don't know how many gigabits they're doing now. But the problem is that as the frequencies go, or the switching speeds go higher, the frequency content of the pulses goes higher. And therefore, it's harder and harder to keep them isolated. So now what you have is you have first insulation on individual pairs in the cable, which I think happened first to keep them from coupling together. And then the outer jacket that you're talking about seeing through the cover was added to keep signals from other sources, such as radio transmitters, out of the systems. And vice versa, by the way, it also tends to keep the pulses inside the cable so it doesn't interfere with other services. So that all can work. The problem is the shield is only as effective as the way the ends are terminated. And in many cases, the equipment that they're plugged into was designed for the earlier kinds of standards, and the ground connection from the shield may not exist, or if it exists, it may not be well grounded through a short line to the chassis or something. It may go into the circuitry and rattle around for a while and coupled everything in there. So I think the shield effectiveness is probably mostly limited by the design of the equipment on the ends, whereas the ferrite toroid reduces any currents flowing and keeps that current from entering the equipment if it's done properly and is upright against the equipment. So I think they're sort of separate phenomenon, and they help even more if you do both.
Yes.
And I've had that experience. I changed from my station. I had some problem with my window line transmission line coupling to a Ethernet cable that was connected to my home network. I think it was running from a ancient 10 megabit per second dumb hub, which had probably never been designed to suppress interfering signals and didn't know about shielding, and therefore was probably not properly terminated, and nor was my old computer. The ham radio computer is always in our house the oldest computer. They kind of go from my office to Nancy's office to the dog's office and then finally down to my station. So they get an old computer and an old hub that probably have poor grounding. So the shielding, in my case, didn't help, but the toroid on the shielded cable worked fine. It probably worked better than the toroid on a non-shielded cable, but I don't know that I made that distinction. I think I did. At first, I had the shielded cable, and it was still having a problem, and then I put a toroid as well, and the problem went away. So they're still there, even though the computers are different than they were then. So I think the idea is that they both can be helpful, but it depends a lot on the details of the equipment.
All right, Joel, I have one more question for you to torment you with. This is Martin, W3PR, and he's asking, a while ago, one of the Doctor podcasts covered how high is high, pertaining to antenna height, of course. Perhaps another episode could be how low is low, covering beverage antennas and other low-band receiving antennas. Is there any point to using such antennas on the upper HF bands? Which is a good question. You usually see them in the context of, say, 160 meters or 80 meters. What about higher?
Well, that is a good question. And we should perhaps talk a little bit about what, for some people may not be familiar with the idea of a beverage antenna. And when people talk about how high is high, and they think of beverages, they may go in a completely different direction. So we won't dwell there too long.
Or even receiving antennas.
Yes.
Generally.
Yes,
yeah.
Receiving antennas in generally. Basically, the idea is that the beverage antenna, first, what it is, it's an antenna that's typically 1 to 2 wavelengths long. And it's just a piece of wire, typically 6 or 8 feet above the ground, best over fairly level ground, with a terminating resistor at its far end. And what happens is, the reason it works for receiving is that as a signal, a vertically polarized signal, goes across the ground, the loss in the ground results in a tilt in the waveform, or the wavefront, such that the vertical polarized signal becomes partly horizontally polarized in the direction that it's traveling. And so it actually couples to the wire. And as the signal continues along the wire, it continues to couple in phase with the signal that came in the last couple of feet. So at the far end of this 1 to 2 wavelength wire, you end up with a signal from the particular direction being one that is down the wire, like from your station end, the opposite end from the terminating resistor. You hear signals coming from the direction of the terminating resistor, and they add up together and combine into a load at the receiver, which should be matched to about the same 400 or 500 ohm impedance. And what that does is that gives you a very directive antenna, which is very hard to get on 160 and 80 meters. You need a very large antenna. Of course, this is big, but it's big only in length. It's not tall. It's not heavy. There's no radials. There's no fancy stuff. It just sits there at near the ground, and it receives signals. And what it does is it receives signals that are coming in vertically polarized at low elevation angles from that particular direction. So what does it do for you? It eliminates picking up signals from other directions, and that's particularly helpful if the noise or interference is coming from other directions. So you have eliminated the high angle signals that often come in from relatively close sources of atmospheric noise, such as thunderstorms, which is a big component of most atmospheric noise. It's typically coming in at high angles, depending on how far away it is. You get rid of stations that are coming in from other places. You get rid of local noise sources that are not in the direction you're trying to listen to. So, of course, if the noise is coming from exactly the same direction and at the same elevation angle as the station you're trying to listen to, it doesn't work. But in general, since the noise can be coming from all over, you end up with an improved signal-to-noise ratio compared to usually the wide coverage antennas that you use for transmitting. Now, it's very inefficient because you get just a small portion of the signal, so you have to amplify it usually. And the reason it's effective is because the signal-to-noise ratio that you receive on low-frequency bands, 160, 80, and sometimes 40 meters, is usually limited by outside atmospheric or other noises. So if you have loss in the antenna, as you do here, both the signal and noise tend to go down together. But if you've got an antenna that picks up a stronger copy of your signal and less noise, even though it's inefficient, it gives you an improved signal-to-noise ratio. So you actually can hear a signal that you wouldn't be able to hear on your transmitting antenna. You look at the S-meter and you don't see much movement of the S-meter. It doesn't look as strong as it would on the transmitting antenna, but because you have to amplify it some more and so forth. But what you've done is you've increased the signal compared to the noise. So why doesn't this work on 20 meters, 15, 10 meters? Well, on those bands, generally, if you start reducing the efficiency of the antenna, the signals get limited by receiver noise inside the receiver. Mm-hmm. And what happens is then, if you reduce the amplitude of the input signal, you can't improve the signal-to-noise ratio compared to the receiver noise because it stays the same.
Okay.
So you're reducing the input signal, and you can sort of never, you can't make that back with amplification, typically.
I mean, no.
It's just you're stuck with what you got there. So that's why it doesn't work. Now, there are other kinds of antennas that can be used to do this. They've all been described in QST, but there's a loop designed by K9AY. There's the U antenna, spelled E-W-E.
Like the sheep.
Like the sheep.
Yes.
But actually, the antenna has the shape of a U. It's kind of a pun. By WA2WVL. There's also a flag antenna and a pennant antenna and some kinds of receiving loops that can also approach the beverage but don't require this large expanse of real estate. And most successful operators trying to work long distances on 160 and 80 meters have, particularly 160, have taken advantage of this. And of course, it's also effective on our new MF, lower frequency MF bands and LF bands. And that's where they really started being used by Beveridge in the, 20s. So it's a good thing to look into if you're interested in operating in those frequency ranges.
Well, another mailbag is in the bag.
All right.
Thank you, Joel.
My pleasure.
ARRL, The Doctor Is In, is brought to you by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. For more information on amateur radio or the ARRL, visit us on the web at www.arrl.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for ARRL. If you have a question or comment for The Doctor, send an email to doctor@arrl.org. Background music is courtesy of Ben Sound at www.bensound.com. This program is provided under the copyright of the ARRL. Until next time, I'm QST Managing Editor Becky Schoenfeld, W1BXY. 73, and thanks for listening.